Osiris.
Hey, we're live. What's up, everybody? This is RJ. I'm here with Brian and Matt. We are part of this show called The Live Show, and we're live right now. That's all related. Hey, Matt. Hi, Brian. How you guys doing?
What's up?
I'm having a frustrating morning, you know. Tickets for the E Street Band's tour next year went on sale for a lot of our local locations this morning. A lot to talk about there. A lot of controversy happening out in the world, but we'll get to that. Otherwise, feeling quite cheery.
Otherwise. What about you, Brian?
Good. I've got one of my kids is in camp this week, which is like the greatest break in our entire life right now. I dropped him off. Felt like we were like back in the school year. It was amazing. And my other kid has 101 temperature. So like I'm just rolling along just perfectly right now.
I feel like today was one of those days where, like, in addition to the trying to get tickets to the concert that Matt mentioned, also like I couldn't get my printer to work, and like my Wi-Fi kept like going between the two networks, and I was trying to get like nothing worked, and it's so frustrating when all these things that are designed to be helpful just don't work. And so I don't know, maybe it's related to the moon cycle.
Maybe it's something in the air tonight, today, this morning. I don't know. Different 80s song, but could be.
So we're going to talk about Bruce Springsteen today. I guess I'm still in line, guys. 2 hours and 4 minutes after tickets went on sale for Bruce at the Wells Fargo Center next spring. I'm pretty sure once it gets through, probably maybe 6 hours or so from now, I'll probably get some pretty sweet tickets. So I'm excited about that. I remain optimistic. But Matt, do you want to summarize what the ticket controversy and the not ticket controversy? Well, I guess we had an exchange about Bob Lefsetz's newsletter, which we can also talk about. But what's the controversy, Matt?
Well, you know, a lot of us have been through Ticketmaster changes in the last couple of years for buying fish tickets, other types of tickets that are highly in demand, where you got to get them as soon as they go on sale. And so I don't think there was a lot of surprise to those of us who have been doing that in terms of the actual process, now that they do the verified pre-sale thing and whatnot. And I have thoughts on that. But the Bruce fans had basically not been through this. And Springsteen on sale is basically as intense as it comes. Like, if you have problems with like fish on sales being stressful, this is like a completely different ballgame. I mean, it's like you've never experienced demand like this, especially when you're trying to buy tickets for, like, you know, Philly or one of his kind of core markets. But the real thing that surprised everybody was that Bruce, as many large artists are doing now, especially legacy artists, is using this dynamic pricing feature on Ticketmaster, where essentially they price things as airlines do. So, like, if you've ever noticed, like, you know, if you look for an airline ticket and you don't buy it right away, but you keep kind of checking it out, the price slowly starts to go up because they recognize that as demand for the ticket, and they're like, okay, we can charge more, et cetera, et cetera. I had this happen for one show that I saw, and it actually worked in my favor when I saw Genesis this past winter, that I bought tickets in a pre-sale and got them, you know, at lower levels at a okay but expensive price. And when they went on sale to the public like 2 days later, they were twice as much. So, you know, it can kind of work both ways. The stories that came out in this case for the boss were that, tickets like on the floor were being priced up to as much as like $4,000, which is ridiculous. So I think this dynamic pricing thing seems like they've got their justification about stopping scalping and stuff, but it doesn't seem like it's a great service to the fans. And then also the fact that, you know, things are getting so out of control for, you know, a certain set of tickets. So, I mean, what do you guys think, just in terms of like the dynamic and pricing and everything like that? I mean, what were your thoughts?
It's weird because the only option really seems to be that you buy a ticket to a concert and that is your ticket and you are locked in completely and there's no like technological workaround for this. And so you like decide in the on sale that you're going to a concert and you're going. I don't really know of a system that could be in place that would prevent any sort of resale, which would then prevent the upselling of these ticket prices, which they're kind of trying to just get beyond that and get to, you know, what is the value of this ticket going to be like the day of the concert. So I feel like the only option for like an artist like Bruce Springsteen is just to overplay in markets and do like what he does in New York, New Jersey and play like 10 shows so that everybody can basically get in. But you still find the same issue where people are just going to buy tickets to all of those concerts and then sell them over. So I don't know if I really have an answer. It's kind of this, it's this like built in challenge that we have right now with the ticketing marketplace. I don't know. What do you think, RJ?
I mean, I guess it, like the idea is to bring the scalping in house, right?
Right.
Yeah. Like, so like, I don't know. I mean, I guess from a business perspective, it's great for Live Nation, you know, to be able to have those, the cut of those profits. But I don't know. I mean, I guess if it's like, there's something about the like verified resale thing that I think if you look at it from a strictly like security safety perspective, it makes sense. If you look at it from like an affordability standpoint, it doesn't really. So I don't know. I mean, getting rid of like, if you could totally eliminate scalpers in the traditional sense, but have this system, would that be a good trade-off?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a dark analogy, but I keep thinking about, cause they use these things like, oh, we're going to charge so much more because then you're going to pay the same price, but your money's going to go to Bruce instead of to a scalper, right. Which is like, and the whole thing, you know, dynamic pricing, it just reeks of like finance bros in the background being like, well, this is the economic model for it and why you should be doing this, and completely ignores the tradition of patrons of the arts paying a certain amount to see and experience this music, which, you know, in Bruce's case, he's been one of the legacy acts who up until now did actually set very firm ticket prices that were reasonable compared to other artists of his, you know, level. I mean, I think on the River Tour, when I saw him, upper level tickets in the arenas were 100 and lower level in floor was 150, which for an act of that status is actually like a very affordable deal.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, McCartney and the Stones and stuff like that, like you're paying like $300 to see them in like halfway decent seats. The other thing is that this whole thing about, you mentioned scarcity, Brian, like this has actually been Bruce's model and the model that several other acts have used going back to the 80s, which is you play an arena tour that's short. You do single nights, maybe two nights in your bigger markets for a couple of weeks. And then there's this insane demand because people can't get tickets to that. So then you come back around 6 months later and you play in a stadium where you can fit as many people as you know, 60, 70, 80,000 people. And so you have the demand for those shows, and it's not like, oh, well, you know, he just came through here and I got to see him 6 months ago. Why would I want to see him in a stadium now? There's a lot of people who didn't get to go to the show who want to go to the show now. And that's fine. But once again, the dynamic ticket pricing is a problem. And there's a whole nother conversation we can have about Ticketmaster's technology and the way that the on sales work right now, which, unpopular opinion, I actually think the way that they're doing things now is by and large the right way that they should be doing it for fairness. I know that a lot of people don't agree with that, but it's really, for me, it comes down to the pricing, which is very disappointing that Bruce would buy into that model. So, you know, I went to the on sale this morning. I got some tickets for DC. I'm still in the waiting line with RJ for Philly and sure that something's going to happen there. But in the back of my mind, I'm like, you know what? They've already said they're going to do stadiums in fall, late summer of 23. So I'll plan on going then. And
you know that they'll come back around.
Exactly. I know that's going to happen. Those shows, the other thing is those shows actually tend to be way more epic. Like the arena shows are pretty like tight and focused. The stadiums, that's where he winds up going 4 hours and like all hell breaks loose. So I'm looking forward to that.
I think one thing that's interesting, we hear, just to kind of put a bow on this, we hear the argument that, you know, you hear it in sports, you hear it in music as well, that we're trying to, you know, recoup profits that were lost during the pandemic. And I think from an art standpoint, from a musician standpoint, that's incredibly understandable. I think the challenge is everyone's really squeezed right now. And the one thing I wish that we would see more is, we see this in the jam band community, is the option for a live stream where it's a discounted price essentially for a concert delivered right to your home. That gives you the option, at least from a consumer, from a patron of the arts, as you said, to experience the concert while not necessarily being in the venue, while not necessarily having to go through the entire pressure of buying a ticket on the on sale. It would allow people more access to this and would allow, you know, from an overall revenue standpoint, an opportunity for an artist to recoup even more money for people who wouldn't necessarily go to the concert and not be able to get into the concert, to at least have a chance to experience it. You talk about a stadium show, though, which is a pretty nice transition to where we're at here. And we also talk, I just mentioned webcasting, which there is a live stream of this concert that we are talking about today, 7388 from Stockholm, Sweden, which is really sweet.
Well, that's what a great segue, Brian. Thank you so much.
Right in.
So, okay, we're going to talk about 7388. This is a fun show. There's a lot to discuss here. But, Brian, do you want to talk about the venue and sort of where the band was quickly, just to give us some context before we get into it?
Yeah. So this Stockholm Stadium opened in 1912 for the Stockholm Olympics. It's got a 33,000 person capacity. This was famously bombed in 1997 as a protest of the Stockholm application for the 2004 Olympics. Which, if you know anything about the 2004 Olympics, all of those stadiums are currently being overgrown in Athens, Greece. It was probably a good thing for Stockholm that they did not go forward with the Olympics that year. This is a gorgeous stadium. It's beautiful. It's really old. It's got this track that runs through it. It's got this overhang over the seats. It's kind of like a single overhang. There's no upper deck to it. There's a huge, massive floor for people to hang out on. Springsteen has played there 8 times, including a 3-night run in 2000, which was his most recent run there. And as we're going to get to in a later show this week, he seems to love Scandinavia. He has a total vibe, which, coming from like the working man vibe of Bruce Springsteen in, you know, the factories of New Jersey, you wouldn't think that Scandinavia would appeal to him, but he is in love with it. And maybe he just likes the social safety net. I don't know. I'm a fan of myself. This show happened on July 3rd, 1988. And just two quick fun factoids about what was happening in the world at this point in time. Gene Nelson of the Oakland A's became the first pitcher on this date to steal a base since 1973, and in 98 went over the Toronto Blue Jays. You don't see a lot of pitchers stealing bases. And now with the designated hitter in both leagues, you really just don't see it anymore. But also, 3 big songs in the top 5 in the U.S. charts. Def Leppard's Pour Some Sugar on Me, INXS, New Sensation, and Michael Jackson's Dirty Diana. We're in like a late 80s pop music high at this point in time.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and this sound is, it's one of the things I was thinking as I was listening to this is, I was sort of like, last week I think I was making fun of the 80s sound during the intro to Cover Me from the 85 show, which is like, it's just very 80s. It just doesn't, you know, even though that obviously it came out around that time, but compared to the album version, at least, but they played the same kind of intro, but I kind of like this better because it's like so 80s that it's like over the top 80s. You know what I mean? As opposed to like the transitioning to the 80s. I mean, it's like the synthesizers they're more prominent, but they're also more balanced. I don't know. This just has such like a late 80s sound. I feel like the sound of the show overall, like just the mix and the instruments, were better than the 85 show, which sounded to me a little bit harsh. But I don't know. Do you guys agree with that? Disagree with that? Have you thought about that? Because I think I really like the sound of the show.
This is one of the better sounding releases from the Archive series, I think. And as epic as the Giants Stadium show is that we talked about last week, that is, I think, one of the poorer sounding releases in this series. This is, you know, as you mentioned, going all in on the 80s, I was kind of thinking like, you know, Bruce, this is his like in probably from 88 until like the mid 90s. This was like his into the mainstream culture as Bruce kind of tried to be, and then he sort of got back to being Bruce. So the synthesizers, the whole, like, I don't know if you guys have seen video of it, but like the intro to the shows on this tour, the Tunnel of Love Express tour, is like so cheesy. Like literally, like they have like a carnival barker on stage and they all like come on one at a time and give their ticket to the carnival guy and like skip onto stage, and which was, you know, that's like what happened in big shows in the late 80s. Yeah. And he was just like, at the time people probably thought this was like cool as hell, but in retrospect it did not age well. And then also, you know, this, I know we're going to talk a lot about the sound of the album Tunnel of Love. That's as 80s as it got. I mean, so many synthesizers and drum machines and, you know, he was going with the flow. That's a sound that wound up becoming somewhat passe for a while, but, in a preview of, I think, what Brian and I are both going to talk about, it's something that came around again later and is really regarded as a great sound now.
I think also to the point, he focuses so much of the first set of this show on Tunnel of Love material, and that is built specifically for this. You know, the second to last song as well of the first set is Born in the USA, which is, you know, an introduction to Bruce Springsteen with the synthesizer for a lot of listeners. And so you get this mix in the first 14 songs of the show that feel a part of the era. You know, there's a few songs, Adam Raised a Cane, The River, that harken back to, you know, the 70s, the 80s, this kind of gritty barroom sound that you got of the early 80s, I should say, that you got from Bruce Springsteen that many people expected. But he's really fitting the set list around a sound here, which I think helps in terms of you're not hearing anything out of place in a way that we might have in the 85 show, where he was kind of throwing a greatest hit set while also redefining his sound in so many cases.
So this 34 song show, which is just, that's pretty wild. I'm a real, like, I'm a fan of Tunnel of Love. And I love the first kind of quarter of this show that focuses heavily on those songs. They're like pretty tuned in, you know, they sound really good. What are some of your highlights of the first kind of set, or if you want to talk about the sound as opposed to specific songs, jump in.
One thing that we didn't specifically mention yet is that the first set of this show was broadcast live on FM radio in the US. So a couple of things there. A, it wound up being one of the most highly circulated bootleg recordings of Bruce's career for quite a while. The other thing is that they tailored the first set towards, I think, you know, it being the radio broadcast, because the second set they play completely without the broadcast. It wasn't until this album came out a few years ago that we actually got to hear the second set of the show. They changed the set list of the standard show from this time to kind of pack more of the good stuff, featuring Tunnel of Love, as you mentioned, RJ, but then also dropping in stuff that would really hit hard, like The River and like Born in the USA. So for me, it's the highlight of set one is that it's very front loaded with like the greatest parts of the Tunnel of Love Express show all kind of packed into one, particularly a run where you have, you know, Cover Me, Brilliant Disguise, Tougher Than the Rest. I mean, that's like, for me, like the ultimate 1-2-3 punch from this era. So Brian, what do you think?
I'm right there with you. I think I would just add Seeds as being a real highlight in this overall first set. But I think it's really interesting the way that he introduces the show here, where Tunnel of Love gives you this, like, it sets the tone of this is 1988. This is Bruce in a very transitional, kind of the entry point to a dark, almost lost era in his career, like basically where he's at in 1988 playing in these stadiums. It's going to be 11 years before, after this tour, before he reunites with the E Street Band and really kind of recaptures that magic in a lot of cases. And we'll talk about the 90s later in this series, but it's so fascinating to me that he walks out, plays Tunnel of Love. It really sets the point of where he's at in his career right now, and then goes right into Boom Boom, Adam Raised a Cane, and The River. And you get this like classic, this like clash between where Bruce artistically, musically wants to go and where he also kind of knows like the fans and his band want him to be and sound best at. So that kind of dichotomy at the start of the show, really, these are all songs I love, but it's also this like tension between where he wants to go, but where he's found his most success to that point in time.
So the one thing, one of the things that I was just listening through to this, and obviously like listened to a lot of live Springsteen, but Patty and Bruce, they're just like, you know, it's like, I guess 3 years from this show or so before they end up getting married and whatever. But some of the vocal dynamics between the two of them are just really great. And I wonder if that, did that like grow over time? Cause I think even in the 85 show, I didn't notice that quite as much. But did that like, is that something that evolved and became more of a focus in terms of the vocal at the live shows over time?
If you watch videos from the 84-85 tour, I mean, to put it bluntly, I think they were definitely together at that point in some mm-hmm. degree, because on mm-hmm. stage they're like literally singing face to face, like centimeters from each other at times. There was a lot of like sexual tension going on between the two of them, but you're right that this is where it sort of skyrocketed, because they were actually like together on this tour, and Bruce's marriage was kind of falling apart at the same time. So you're not incorrect for kind of, you know, getting that vibe from the two of them.
But what about the actual performance? Like, do you guys notice the vocals being like, basically their kind of vocal harmonies seem to be better a couple of years later than they were before? Do you think that was intentional, or do you think that just evolves naturally?
I mean, I get the impression that a lot of these songs, just the way that they're written, they sound better with Bruce singing with a female voice. And I think like the video for Tougher Than the Rest has, there's a great live cut of it that showcases the two of them going back and forth and singing, you know, her singing in harmony. I just think like the way that these songs are tracked, it's a lot different from what you are used to with Bruce Springsteen. You think of The River as like, you put that album on, it's like the greatest barroom record ever. And it kind of requires backing singers that like echo Bruce. And Born in the USA is so big, and his voice is so distinct in that. Tunnel of Love, one of the things I love about it is that his voice comes down in a lot of cases, and he's kind of sing speaking at times, and he's trying to use his voice as an instrument in a lot of other cases. And it just sounds to me like it works better with someone like Patty singing right next to him than just him out at the front of the stage belting out the songs. I mean, these songs are really quiet. They're really small stories. This is a guy who is in his late 30s, who's going through this dual challenge of like being one of the biggest rock and pop stars ever, who's in an era that is totally untapped. Nobody knows what it means to be a rock star going into the latter part of the 1990s. We have hindsight to look back on what these guys were like as they were aging, but also from a simple standpoint, from a small story standpoint, his marriage, his family's falling apart. He's kind of getting the sensation he needs to move on from his band. So all of that kind of mixes together to like work with a voice like Patty's, whereas his earlier stuff just felt like Bruce out in the open.
Yeah. The other thing, I mean, just kind of a simplistic answer, is that when he recorded Born in the USA, he didn't have a girl in the band, right? And then that was added afterwards. So now he's recording Tunnel of Love, and he has he didn't record it with the E Street Band, but he's got the band in the back of his mind, and then probably thinking like, oh, like I can add some harmonies to this song because we have like a higher voice that can sing them, or Patty's voice is going to sound good on this, that, or the other. So, yeah, I mean, it's definitely a lot tighter.
think the you were just talking about the kind of simplicity, some of the stuff, the spare parts in particular that like goes from this piano focused song, and then like by the end it's like this rocking jam with horns. It's really pretty great. And I had another question that I wanted to ask you guys, which is like, isn't Nils like so much more of a rock guitarist than Steve? Like, I feel like maybe it's just the tone at this show, or maybe his guitar is turned up. Maybe in like the older shows, like Steve wasn't turned up as much, but I just hear this like rock guitar coming through so much more heavily in this show than some of the other shows. I haven't listened to as much late 80s Bruce live as I have like late 70s. So maybe that's the difference, but it just feels so much more rocking.
There's so much color in Nils' guitar, and I think like this tour he fits perfectly. And to me, Nils is, he's almost like adding a Mark Knopfler to the background of Bruce Springsteen. And there's just like, there's fills, there's textures that he provides to so many of these songs that I don't know if I would say rocking, but like it adds an element to it that I just absolutely love. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, nothing against Lil Steven, because he's an incredible guitarist, but he's a bar band guitarist, and he's rooted in this garage rock kind of thing, whereas Nils actually has a, you know, way more of a elite pedigree. I mean, let's not forget he was a member of Crazy Horse, you know, before all of this. There's a story about, if you guys know the song Speaking Out on Tonight's the Night, that Neil Young said to Nils, like, hey, I want you to play piano solo here. And Nils was like, I don't play the piano. And he was like, yeah, just play a solo. You'll figure it out. And the solo is amazing on that song. So I think he's got more of like, just kind of like natural musical ability. The other thing I think that affects this is that on this tour, as opposed to, you know, specifically tours from the 70s, I think Bruce was way less interested in playing guitar on stage and more interested in kind of the, you know, grandstanding and running around and stuff like that. I mean, this was a very like image focused tour. They had more like kind of, you know, accoutrements on the stage and stuff like that, as opposed to the E Street Band shows before, which would just be very, very bare bones.
It's interesting to me as well, because, you know, Lil Steven doesn't play on this, on the show. He's not in the band at this point in time. And there's a sensation when you think about the band, when they get back together in 99, as it really fits with Little Steven's image on stage as kind of like Bruce's best friend, and Nils is like right there to the side as like really adding like guitar tones and really adding like undertones that fill out the sound. So they seem to have reached like a happy medium now where like Lil Steven's there for the energy, for the vibe of the overall show, but Nils is there to really like complement and add a ton to the music.
I want to ask you guys, because you guys have more kind of thematic perspective on this show that we haven't talked about yet, but it right before Spare Parts, Bruce does a little like couple sentences in Swedish. How do you guys feel about speaking to the crowd in their native language during concerts? How do you guys feel about that in general? Because a lot of artists do it, and I want to get your perspective on that.
It's got a very Bono vibe to me.
Oh, come on. It's cool. It's cool.
Mick Jagger does
the same thing. Like,
I mean, everyone does it, right? I'm just like, yeah. Do you guys think it's a good... Do you think that people... All right, here's a better question. Do people in those countries, are they like... Do they feel more connected to the artist because they hear the artist in their own language, do you think?
I think so. And I think I don't think it's cheesy. I think it's a sign of respect to the audience that, like, I'm here, I'm going to attempt something. Just two very, very famous examples that I think support that is like, there was when Queen played in, Romania, and Freddie Mercury learned like one of their folk songs in Romania, and he had the words written on his hand and he was singing it, and the audience just goes nuts as they realize what he's trying to do. Same thing happened with Billy Joel when he played in the Soviet Union. He had like a translator on stage. Of course, he didn't do it himself, but he would bring somebody up and be like speaking to them so he could like connect with the Russian audience. And I think that's just not like, hey, I'm here to give you a show, but like, I'm with you. I'm connected to you and I want to play for you.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you. I think it's, there's a sensation of connection. It's funny because it's like this one brief moment in the show. And like for most of the show, like he comes out and there's this like slightly awkward moment where he goes, "Hello, Sweden. Hello, America." And then like you kind of hear him like catch himself because he's like talking to the American crowd that's listening on the broadcast. And he goes, "Hello, world."
Hello, you know, world.
Like, this sense of like we're here in Stockholm. We are in a world city. We are not in America right now.
Yeah. I mean, I noticed that too. And are you ready to ride? Yeah. Hell yeah, man. Let's do it. What else do you guys, what other observations do you guys have listening back to this show?
One thing I'd love to get into, and we hinted at that this a couple minutes ago, Matt wrote this down in our doc for the 85 episode. And I think we got into it, but like, I feel like this provides a really interesting entry point. 1987, 1988 did not age well within like a 3-year period in time. Like we are 3 years away from, which is crazy to think, we're 3 years away from Jeremy, from Smells Like Teen Spirit, from grunge totally taking over. Like every song that I listed that was popular in July of 1988 is almost immediately outdated within 5 years and just sounds like totally different world. We're at a point where like hip hop hasn't even reached the mainstream. Like we are truly at the tail end of the classic rock sunrise and sunset. And all of these artists are about to become our parents' artists. And a decade from now, the Rolling Stones are going to do like a review tour of their entire career. It's going to be one of the biggest tours ever. It's so fascinating to me because now 30 years later, 30 plus years later, this music sounds so present and it sounds so influential. But I'm really curious for you guys, like I see you have this somewhat in your notes, Matt. I have it as well. Like this transition towards late era classic rock and what these artists would do to like kind of redefine themselves, but also like how does this 80s sound in the moment? How does it sound now? Like what is the evolution it's been through? I know that there's a lot there, but I just would love to hear your thoughts on it, Matt.
Yeah, this is something that has been, I think, a keystone of my musical journey in the past probably 10 years, which is that, like, you know, going back to, like, talking about when Bruce was kind of not cool in the 90s, I think a lot of that came from, like, this began in this era. And I remember as I really, really started to get back into Bruce heavily in, like, my 20s, still thinking that, like, you know, Born in the USA and Tunnel of Love were just cheesy 80s albums that, like, there's some good songs on them, but, you know, the recordings were not great. They're very, very dated. And then gradually, the sound of those records has been kind of adopted by a lot of artists in the past 10 years. I think particularly artists who are around our age have come around to these sounds actually being really great. I mean, maybe you take out the gated drums and some things like that, but like the synthesizers and the style of songwriting and the layers of sound, we always reference the War on Drugs. I mean, you know, basically like, you know, if you listen to something like, Tougher Than the Rest, sorry. That's basically the template for every single War on Drugs song.
Yeah.
You know, and like a song like Brilliant Disguise is like so 80s, but then like Elvis Costello covered it like 5-10 years ago. And it's like, man, like what a great song. So I think it's an interesting time to go back and listen to these shows. RJ, you talked about like how 80s it is with the synthesizers and stuff. And there's certain elements that sound a little dated to me, but by and large, it actually kind of sounds like a contemporary band. You know, I think, Brian, that's kind of what you were alluding to.
Yeah, I mean, I had the sensation when I saw the War on Drugs back in February and they play Harmonia's Dream. And that's a song that's like, it's stretched out to 12 minutes. It's so focused on like like there's multiple acoustic guitars that are going, there's like this layering of sound, there's synthesizers that are going, and they're stretching this out over this like very driving, danceable drum beat. And it sounds to me like, you know, it's picked up directly from this Tunnel of Love era. RJ, what are your thoughts? I know that like this sound, I don't want to say it's like grating to you, but I think like, is it challenging for you to listen to like an artist like Bruce Springsteen from like 75 to 80? Where does it fall for you?
No, I mean, this is like you said, this sound is back, you know. I think that maybe that's, you know, like obviously Adam from War on Drugs named his son Bruce. Like there's no, you know, there's no mistaking the connection, but this sound is like, I mean, this could easily, I mean, you know, the I Don't Live Here Anymore, you know, War on Drugs single, there's like Bruce, Tears for Fears, and like a couple other like 80s sounds in that song, and it's a fucking awesome song, you know? So maybe that's why I like this show so much, is because it was so 80s and that sound is just like, it's back. And I don't know. I think the 75, like the late 70s show, like starting with the London show, that's the kind of famous first trip to London where like, I mean, you guys, I'm sure everyone who listens and watches knows that story, but like they were like, who is this fuckhead? And then he like blew them away and then they all became lifelong Springsteen fans or something like that. But like that was just like rocking, putting on like an epic show where everyone like couldn't believe how awesome the show is. And this is like a little bit of like a, this is more of a musical experience in that the songs are tighter. There's more, I think the horns in this show are like more prominent and kind of better. They better complement the music than some of the earlier stuff. So I think this is great, but maybe that's because I like where popular music is going at the moment with harkening back to the 80s.
I think it's also interesting because it speaks so much to technology, and technology is at the root of what made rock music possible. You know, you're basically taking rockabilly chords and, you know, country chords, and you're adding electricity to them, and you're adding distortion, you're adding sound. And 20 years after the peak, you get the synthesizer and you get these like new drum sounds. You get this new ability to like reinterpret the music. And I feel like at the time, and especially as you got into the 1990s, and so much of rock music was like, screw all that, we're going back to basics. It's just guitars, maybe some distortion pedals, but like the goal of rock music is just to like have this guitar speak to you and have like the volume of these drums speak to you. But it's this period in time where technology kind of encroaches and offers another pathway. And I referenced this in our first episode, but like there are a lot of records from the 1980s that showcased artists seemingly lost in the era. Dylan went through this. Neil went through this. Bruce kind of navigated his way through it, but then dives fully in with Tunnel of Love. And it kind of creates an album that like, it was clearly a popular album at the time, but then became almost underrated and underappreciated, and now has come around as like a potential entry point, which possibly segues nicely into your other theme here, Matt. It's like a really serious Bruce Springsteen record, whereas like Born in the USA at face value can seem a bit over the top. Darkness on the Edge of Town, Born to Run, these are records that like, even if you don't actively search out Bruce Springsteen, you know about. Tunnel of Love can seem like, hey, you want like serious Springsteen who like actually talks about like, you know, relationships, go to Tunnel of Love. But this also potentially put him into a corner going forward.
Yeah, I mentioned on the Giant Stadium discussion last week, if you look at the 70s, Bruce had a chip on his shoulder about being from Jersey, trying to get out from his family, almost a little bit of like a gutter punk kind of feel. Like if you saw the E Street Band in the late 70s coming towards you in a dark alley, like you'd get the fuck out of there right then. I mean, somebody's going to cut you. Okay. Yeah. Then you get into the 80s and it's like, they're like sort of adopting, and we talked about Swole Bruce, and now he's more of a man of the people, of the, you know, the working man, the farms and the heartland of America, and the bandana, and you know, you can kind of get that. Now we've transitioned into like superstar but yet emo Bruce, and you know, I mean, with good reason. We talked about the struggles he was having with his marriage. If you read his autobiography, he was, you know, getting very depressed around this point. He was very lost in life. He had moved to LA too, which I think is very like kind of like tainted his view on the world. Like he lost his center from Jersey and was kind of just surrounded by famous people all the time. And so there's something about this show. I mean, it pops up at times, particularly towards the end where you get the big rave up from the E Street Band. But like Bruce is very serious around this time. Like, and it's not outwardly directed. You know, he's not trying to change the world. He's not trying to represent a certain person. He's just very inwardly looking and he's kind of sullen. And like, there's a little bit of joy that's sucked out of the show, I think, because of that. Because he's in his own head too much. So it's interesting to look at that where, you know, we had this, like, talk about the religious experience and everything, and there's some of that here, but also, especially in the first set, this focus on just very, very serious, personal songwriting.
And there's very little of the, like, revival stuff from Bruce also, like, especially in that first set, which is interesting. I'm sure those things are related. Do you guys think that they should have gone back to Annie Leibovitz for the photo, for the Tunnel of Love cover photo? How do you guys feel about that photo now looking back? Because that to me might be the worst part of the album.
The album cover?
Yeah. It's just like the bolo tie, just the whole thing is just like, I don't know. Maybe that's just what you did in the 80s. But I mean, I don't have an alternative cover, but I'm not sure that it aged well.
I like it because how much it puts him in that era. And it showcases this transition between a guy wearing blue jeans and like a white shirt in front of an American flag as like a working man to this more serious middle age. His hair is combed back. He looks a little slimmed down. There was this like great obsession with the 1950s in the 80s. And so like the classic car behind him feels very fitting. It reminds me of Dylan's cover to Empire Burlesque, which like you look at that and you're like, there's no other decade that album came out in than the mid 1980s. And this feels in that vein to me.
Yeah. If you've ever seen the film Roy Orbison, Black and White Night, Bruce was a very prominent part of that. And his bolo tie and slick back hair look plugs straight into what was happening then. So I like the cover because I agree with you, Brian. I think it's a very good snapshot of exactly where Bruce was at that time. And which, as most of his album covers been, I mean, everything that I just described, the evolution from the 80s, like, that's Bruce on the cover, exactly giving you the vibe that he's, you know, he's wanting you to have.
Well, it's interesting because 4 years later, we're going to have the cover of Lucky Town. He's got sunglasses and he's got like a scruffy beard and he's smiling. These are better days. Everything's looking up right now. Like he's come out of, you know, whatever cloud he was under. And that honestly kind of irks me more than this cover because, and we'll talk about it when we get to the 92 show, but it just showcases Bruce kind of like forcing something that wasn't necessarily there, where I love this record in this era because he leans so much into this darkness that is kind of enveloping him at this point in time.
I mean, I going back to this show, just like the kind of summary, I mean, I wouldn't choose an 88 show to listen to if I was looking at nugs.net and looking at Bruce shows, but I really like the show a lot, especially as we've all said, the first, you know, half or quarter is just like, it's a great show. I want to go back and listen to it again. But as we wrap up, we got to talk about the most boss moment. And I'll start before you guys go, because yours are probably more interesting, but you know, the right at the end of Light of Day, toward the end, the band intros, like, you know, there are people who are good at the band intros, but you know, especially the intro of Clarence, you know, with like a bunch of different descriptive words before he introduces him. But I just love that. And then like right after that, there's like a long the crowd going nuts, and then into Born to Run. That like segment is kind of the peak of the show, I think, it, just in terms of like the energy. And I like hearing Bruce do the band intro because it just reminds me of like an old time person who like really focused on that stuff, which really doesn't happen that much in my experience these days.
The band intro is such a specific part of a Bruce show. And I think like you hear the evolution, and we're going to talk about this in our last show of this week, but like you hear the evolution of how much the dude loved Clarence Clemons. And you get the sense at this point in time that there's almost a sadness because he kind of knows the direction he has to go in. And as he's doing these band intros, like you can almost hear it in his head, like counting down the remaining amount of times that he's going to be doing this. And there's this big unknown here where he's just like celebrating this band. I picked right after that with the first encore. I think it's like, it's the one section of the show that just feels like I'm throwing all the hits at you. It's Born to Run, Hungry Heart, and Glory Days. And it's like a 20 plus minute segment of music. The whole thing just, it strikes me as most of this show and most of this tour, I don't want to say it had to be challenging for listeners, but like, I kind of think it might've been for attendees because, you know, you're playing to your current sound, you're playing to your new album, but so many people who are attending just want to hear the Bruce songs that they fell in love with, or just want to hear the Bruce songs that they heard on the radio. And here he gives it to you in one segment. He's like, I know that these are three of the best songs that I've ever written and three of the songs I've like connected with the most audience. So here it is all for you. And then I'm going to come back out for the second encore and I'm going to reach a little bit deeper for like my true fans while also throwing some covers out for people.
Yeah. I'm kind of similar. My most Bruce moment is basically all of the encores. You know, there's three encores, which I think related to what I was talking about last week about the last quarter of Bruce show. You know, like this is kind of like falling back. The first encore, I hate to describe it this way, but it's almost kind of like fan service to me. It's like, all right, you stuck with me through all this stuff. Now I'm going to give you like a tight three songs that you're going like to flip out to. But then I'm also going to come out and do a second and third encore where I'm like doing the old rave up thing. I mean, there's got to be just eyeballing. I mean, at least an hour of encores here. And he plays quarter to three for the first time since 1981. I mean, that's just one of those, you know, goes way, way back to the origins of the E Street Band, Twist and Shout, Sweet Soul Music, and which has some great references, you know, to does Spotlight on the Big Man, Spotlight on the Band. And like, it's really, really great. And I think to kind of contradict myself, what I was saying a couple of minutes ago, like this is the part of the show where you do get that kind of like joy out of the show. And you're going to leave feeling sweaty and exhausted, but kind of revived.
It is wild how much, and this overall tour, just to kind of like step back and look at, I mean, this tour features so many debuts from what they hadn't played on their US leg, and quarter to three coming back at this point in the show. It kind of speaks to like, he really leans into Tunnel of Love in the first leg of the overall tour and really leans into like, you know, this sound that he's currently in, and then starts to bring back songs like Bobby Jean, The River, The Promised Land, Thunder Road throughout this European tour. And it, I think as he was going along, he was kind of realizing where the happy medium was between the current stuff as well as everything that got him to where he was at that point in time.
And you mentioned the tour debuts. We didn't talk about this, but the Downbound Train, Because the Night, Dancing in the Dark, Light of Day, which leads into that band intro, that segment is really great as well. And I think that's a notable kind of like part of the show before the end. Speaking of the end, guys, we are at the end. Tomorrow, actually, first, let me just say, we've gotten some questions about the sequencing of this. And we had a long and involved Slack exchange about this, the three of us. And because so many of these releases are not available right now on music platforms, likely because of the publishing changes and all that stuff, we are jumping around a little bit, but I think it'd be fair of us to give you a preview of what's next. So Brian and Matt will be back tomorrow. I'm going to be on the road, but these guys are going to take you to the birthplace of television. Everyone knows it. Passaic, New Jersey, from 920-78. So that's where we're going next, in case you want to listen beforehand or listen, you know, after. But we're going there tomorrow, and this is only a 22 song show, so you know there's less to digest there, but pretty amazing period as well.
If you want to do the homework, it's going to pay off. I'm going to give a little bit of a spoiler. This recording that we're going to talk about is my all-time favorite Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band live recording.
Oh my god!
Wow. There's a lot to talk about. So do the homework and come along for the ride tomorrow with us.
Well, I'm going to listen to the show, and I'm going to listen to you guys tomorrow live from the road. So we're going to be back tomorrow for those of you watching at 12 o'clock. And of course, if you're listening as a podcast, spread the word, give us reviews, help us get the show out in front of more people. And I think that's it. Anything else, guys, before we wrap up?
Can't wait to dive back into New Jersey, Bruce, at the Height of the Darkness tour tomorrow. But this was a great listen from 88. Thanks, everyone.
Sell me your tickets for Bruce and Philly at a very reasonable price, please.
Thanks, everybody. I think by the time we go on air tomorrow, Matt and I might still be in line, but I hope you guys aren't. thanks, guys. Talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, everyone.
Osiris.